thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 56 for May 7th, 2010. Past play.
Welcome, everyone, to Digital Campus number 56. I'm Mills Kelly from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, joined by our regular podcast crew, Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Hey, Mills, how you doing?
I'm doing quite well, quite well. Good. It's a beautiful day here in Fairfax, Virginia.
It is, and I hope my mic sounds okay. I'm on a new headset because I was podcasting so hard last time that I literally broke the microphone off of my old headset.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
Just
I
had snapped right off. That's how hard I work on Digital Campus.
That's our podcast.
My commitment. Yes.
And then also Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Tom, how's it going?
Hey, guys. All right.
Good. Good. And we have two special guests today as part of our Digital Campus irregular crew. They are from north of the border. We have Kevin Key, who is the Canada Research Chair at Brock University in beautiful Niagara, New York. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mills.
And I should say Canada Research Chair of Humanities Computing, which makes him especially relevant to the topics we like to talk about. And then we also have Bill Turkell, who's an Associate Professor of History at Western Ontario University. Bill, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Mills. Good to be here.
Great. Well, we're really glad to have you guys. The reason we have Kevin and Bill with us today is because they have just finished the coordination of a fantastic digital history and digital humanities conference at beautiful Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario, which I was lucky enough to attend last week. And the title of the conference was Playing with Technology in History. And it was a really very, very interesting conference focused on what happens when people start playing around with technology or inducing their students to play around with technology in history. And so we've invited Bill and Kevin to join us today to talk a little bit about the conference and the idea behind it, what they think came out of it. So, Kevin, let me throw this to you first and say just what induced you to do this in the first place?
I like organizing conferences. So, you know, that's part of it. It was just the opportunity to get people together. I think Bill and I, and certainly you guys and a bunch of people, have been feeling for a while like we needed to be more playful with history. And I remember talking with you about this, Mills. You know, we thought the best way to do that was to gather a bunch of people who struck us as being quite playful and see what came out of it. The impetus originally started with the History Education Network. And what I mean is that they were the ones who were funding the conference, and so they got the ball rolling. And the History Education Network, or then HIER, because it's Histoire Education Réseau in French, is an organization that was formed to promote the improvement of, or the bettering of, teaching and learning history in Canada. And it's funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, and specifically a research cluster grant. And so what SHRC, the larger funding body, is trying to do through these grants is create organizations that can create links with other organizations. So what we're doing at Then HIER is we're bringing together museums and researchers and universities and you name it, everybody interested in teaching and learning of history. And we're holding different events and finding different means to bring people together. And we had a symposium last year, and then they turned to me and said, can you organize a second symposium on technology? And I said, that's fine, but we've got to do better than that. And so Bill and I started to talk, and what came out of our conversations was that we should really focus on how we can play with technology, what's special about technology in terms of how we can interact with it. And I think ultimately what we really wanted to get at was engagement. So we put this together and we brought together a bunch of wonderful people who came from very different perspectives and had a great couple of days.
Well, yeah, it was certainly one of the more productive, it seemed like one of the more productive conferences I've been to in a long time, in the sense that people really remained engaged. It, you know, it was a small group. How many people were there altogether?
About 20 altogether.
Yeah, about 20 people, and so we were able to all be in the same room together for a couple of days. But the first part of the conference was actually, the first day was an unconference, and Bill, you kind of wrangled the unconference. Why did you guys decide to do it that way first?
Well, one of the things that I've been quite interested in lately, and one of the things I think that informed the idea of doing something with play, was that much of what we know how to do and would like to communicate with one another is tacit. And I feel like if somebody stands up and gives a talk, that doesn't necessarily come across. Excuse me. But that if you get people in a room where they can do things with their hands and minds at the same time, and it's kind of less formal, that some of that kind of tacit knowledge and tacit understanding can be communicated.
And Dan, Tom, you know, we've had some of these unconferences here at the center as well. Tom, from your perspective, what's the real advantage of the unconference model?
Well, I think Bill's getting at it. Exactly. I think that, you know, one of the big advantages is that it allows for knowledge creation, knowledge dissemination that isn't necessarily oral or written. It allows for, you know, group coding. It allows for other kinds of interactions that aren't, you know, listening or talking or writing. So that's part of it. I think also part of it is that it is kind of democratizing in the sense that it breaks down some of the barriers between the, you know, the person on the stage and the people in the audience. It breaks down barriers between people's at different stages of their careers, people in different who perform different roles in their jobs, whether they're librarians or teaching faculty or whatever they are. So I think, you know, between, you know, different kinds of communication, different kinds of knowledge dissemination, and a more democratic interaction, I think that those are the things, to my mind, that make it a productive alternative to kind of a more traditional format. And it sounds like you guys had some of those same kinds of interactions up in Niagara on the Lake.
Yeah, but you know, I have to say, I really missed sitting in the audience and listening to 3 20-minute papers being read plus a 20-minute discussant paper being read, you know, because I had to pay attention in the unconference the whole time, as opposed to letting my mind just kind of wander off to wherever it wanted to go, as I normally do at academic conferences. So
we could arrange this for you, Mills. I mean, I'd be happy to just give a lecture to you for an hour, maybe.
You know, I would get so much more intellectual work done if you would do that, Dan. Maybe you could just like stop by my office once a day.
Get so much more email done.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can get your email done in a regular conference.
I mean, you know,
as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection while you're listening. You know, what I found about that, I totally agree with Tom, and it really sounds like this conference is a case of this, but I also have come to see the unconference format as a way to begin things, to sort of be playful, play around at something, but also to kind of start new projects, to germinate new ideas. And I kind of feel like the standard academic conference is a way to disseminate, well, sometimes, you know, what you've learned. Like, here's a chapter from my book, here's my essay.
Finished work as opposed
yeah,
to...
Yeah, finished work, right. And I think it turns out that I think most academic work is in other stages than that. And, you know, I think also by the time you get to an academic conference where there are talks, you kind of already know, like, so-and-so is doing a dissertation on X or Y, or, oh yeah, that professor just wrote a book on this thing, and now he's going to give a talk on a book, on that book. And I think there's really a lot of room for a conference where you're just thinking broadly, you have an open mind, you pick up, Tom, as you noted, maybe some new tacit knowledge, because I think a lot of work in digital humanities is as Tom, you've expressed on your blog, is sort of methodological rather than theoretical, and often sort of just hands-on work, whether it's coding work or in Bill's case, you know, physical computing work, things that sort of don't make sense from a lecture standpoint. And then once you communicate that kind of knowledge and are open to collaboration, and that's, I think, another big part of it, rather than everyone showing how smart they are, you're thinking about potential collaborations and things you can work on, either, you know, centrally or in a decentralized way. And, you know, I think that's why we've been able to launch things out of that camp. And I've seen other conferences where, you know, for instance, the crisis camps that have gone on over the past couple of years, where, you know, new software has emerged that's really helped out in Haiti or other disasters. There's some software that came out of one of these unconferences that's being used actually in the Gulf region right now for this oil spill, where people can tweet in sightings of slicks, and it auto-generates a map for rescuers and others to use. So I think, you know, if that's your goal, if you want to try to start something, the unconference is a great place to do it.
So so that raises then the question for Kevin and Bill is, what do you think got started?
Wow. Certainly there was the creation of a lot of relationships. And so, you know, what really jumps out for me with these unconferences, and this was the first one I've really been a part of, I was a part of a workshop that Bill had organized that felt very unconference-like, but I think doesn't follow the model that you guys have at that camp and other places. So, you know, I went into this thinking, yeah, I really want to do an unconference, but I'm not really sure how they work. And what struck me was that there was the opportunity to build relationships that people, I think, had wanted to form, but just didn't have the chance to. And I'm at a smaller institution. I'm not in a major urban center. And so one of the things that I feel as an academic is that I'm a bit isolated. I can't get together with a group of 10 like-minded people in my field. Maybe nobody can, save for, you know, two or three places on the continent, but that's certainly the impression that I have. And so I go to conferences really wanting to build relationships so that we can do something together in the future. And that came out because we had the opportunity on that first day to just hang out and to make things and to discuss ideas in a more unstructured fashion. But there was a tangible output too. And that's where this conference was perhaps a little bit different from other unconferences, because what we did is we merged not really a traditional format with this new format, because what we did on day two was still a little bit unusual. But in the same way that a lot of conferences have as their purpose the assembly and presentation of papers so that they can be published in a larger set of papers later on, each person that came to the symposium had written a paper. And so, Bill, maybe we can talk in a second about what happened on the first day, but just for a moment, sticking on the second day, what we did is we took those papers and we didn't present them, but everyone else commented on what the writer had said, and then talked about opportunities for how the paper might be changed or adjusted in light of the other papers that we were discussing on the second day and in light of what happened on day one. So we're going to be coming out with a book that will probably be called Pass Play. And right now we're exploring the different opportunities and options for how it might be published and what the web presence and everything else will be. But that will be a real tangible result, because you've got a bunch of people who really focused on putting down on paper and, you know, creating digital artifacts that can express some of their ideas. So that was one output. And Bill, what do you think about outputs from day one?
Well, I think that just to explain briefly, on day one, what we did was we had a room that we called the toy room, and we had people have a chance to experiment with a number of different kinds of technologies, everything from Lego Mindstorms and RFID, radio frequency ID tags, to Arduinos, to 3D printing in the form of MakerBot, to a little computer-controlled machine that can cut pictures and patterns out of paper, out of sticky back vinyl, that kind of thing. in the other room, while we were kind of, while the toy room was open and people could go from station to station and learn how to use these various fabricating technologies, in the other room, people like Rob McDougall were leading sessions on kind of game design, leading people through a series of what Rob called barely games, these kind of things that are almost don't even deserve such a grand title as game, but they're certainly a kind of a form of reflective play. And I think that in addition to the kind of obvious book outcome, the relationships that were forged there, I think that things like kind of techniques, toys and games also came out of day one and can be used in our further research.
And so, I think what also came out were just new ideas about how we do conferences generally. So certainly the unconference is an established form in large part because of what you guys are doing at George Mason. But what we were trying to do more broadly was play with beyond just the notion of conference, play with the notion of book, play with the expression of our research in the creation of items, just generally play with the forms in which we're operating and the methodologies that you were talking about, Dan.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective as one of the participants, Kevin, you asked the question about sort of what happened from day one to day two. And I noticed as day two went on and we were talking about various papers, all throughout the day people were bringing in examples of things that had happened on day one and that was in these examples and somehow informing their thinking about what they were doing then on what they were talking about on day two. So so I certainly saw a lot of that connection. And I think that is one of the things that I personally liked about the conference is that you know, day one was really the unconference and we got to do what we wanted and focus on the things that we were interested in and play around with various things. But on day two, we had to a degree, put our nose to the grindstone and get some work done also that was going to have some sort of a tangible outcome because while as a participant in other unconferences, I've, you know, had some wonderful ideas and I've built some great relationships with other scholars. I will say that I'm not sure sort of what the tangible thing was that I walked away with. And in this case, at a minimum, I walked away with some great comments on my paper and some great ideas from other people's papers. So, and I think, you know, the book is going to be really interesting when it's done.
You know, I'm going to be at VacCamp London, which I'll advertise right now, which is in early July and just before Digital Humanities 2010. And one thing that's neat for that conference that I think speaks to this point about, you know, outcomes and maybe making them a little clearer is that JISC, which is the sort of, I don't know, I wouldn't say the equivalent of SHRC or NEH, but it's a major funding body for the digital humanities in the UK. And they're putting up some money, you know, not a lottery ticket's worth of money, but an iPad's worth of money for a kind of challenge as part of that Camp London, where developers and others can kind of come in and build a tool and it will be judged during DH 2010. And I think a prize awarded for the sort of, you know, best outcome and groups can form and things like that. But kind of a neat idea just to spin on this to have something tangible come out of it that that can get recognition as well. Because, you know, the comment I often hear about the unconferences is, you know, how do you get the travel budget to go to it? Because, you know, well, I'm not really presenting a paper. I'll just be talking to other people and something might come out of it. Now, it seems like on Playing with History, you guys actually had papers. So that was a good justification. But
yeah, that always helps.
What do others think about the extensibility of this model to, let's say, I don't know, medieval history or, you know, other fields in the humanities that might not have any physical computing pieces or don't really circulate a lot of their members in digital humanities circles. Is this something? I mean, we've clearly borrowed the unconference model from BarCamp and these sorts of kind of techie areas, but do you think it can expand out to other areas of academia?
I think it can. I mean, you raised the question of medieval history. One of my favorite examples of this kind of more unconventional interaction is a course that Anne McCants has taught with a number of colleagues at MIT over the years, where she brings in students and teaches them how to cook various kinds of medieval recipes. And then they, you know, sit around and eat the recipes and think about cuisine and stuff like that. But one of the funny things is just how disgusting medieval food really is.
Oh, it's terrible.
Not only prepare, but eat. Yeah.
Yeah, and ancient Roman food is even worse. It's almost inedible.
It wasn't delivery pizza?
No, it definitely wasn't.
So our audience will know that I am all about the unconference and new models of scholarly communication. And so this is kind of a devil's advocate question, but I think one question that a skeptic might ask is, so where's the history, right? So, you know, playing with Legos sounds great. I love it. I wrote my college admissions entrance essay on playing with Legos, but another story. But you know, where's the humanities content in all of this? What can we actually, you know, learn? What could you use in a classroom to teach history to students? What can you use to grow scholarly knowledge, grow historical knowledge in all of this? And, you know, I think that's a criticism we get about a lot of what we do. And you know, it's maybe more focused when we start thinking about play and you know, I think we get to the heart of that question in situations like that. So where's the beef, I guess, to borrow something from the 1980s.
It's a great question, because the real answer is we don't know until we get in there. And, you know, that's precisely the point from my perspective. My focus tends to be on simulations and serious games in history. And so, you know, the first line in my explanation when I'm talking about this is that we've gotten used to expressing history as text, and that's part of the problem. We need to move beyond. So what are the other forms that we can explore? And as you guys well know, Rory Rosenzweig and others were saying and have been saying for a while that people love history. They don't necessarily like it in the way that we as academics express it. So, you know, partly what happened over the course of the 20th century was that history went from being something very general to being something in the academy we thought we owned, and we made it fit into tight little boxes. And so now we need to break out, and we don't necessarily know when we start what they're going to look like, because we can at times be stuck in the forms that we've got. So that Bill will have, I think, a much more cogent answer to this, but the reason that I started to go down this path was just so I could sit down with people like you, Mills, and find out about how to organize a course in a way that I never would have imagined before.
Okay, Bill, the more cogent answer?
The pressure's on, Bill.
Yeah, I don't think I have a more cogent answer. I would just kind of sort of underline what Kevin says and say, you know, we readily appreciate that we live in a material world, and that every sort of object around us is some kind of time traveler from the past. And yet, for some reason, we choose to convey our consciousness of the past, our understanding of the past, often in text, you know, more rarely in picture or video or sound, and sort of least, at least for professional historians, least frequently of all, as actual physical objects. But we have the capacity now to make an amazing range of different objects and materials and so forth, and to make objects actually interact with people by embedding various kinds of, you know, small computers and sensors and stuff in them. It seems to me that the possibility of remaking environments and artifacts and so forth so that they can actually communicate theses about the past or convey a kind of sense of historical consciousness is really one of the great opportunities that we have available to us right now.
And, you know, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I'm sort of reminded in Kevin and what you were saying about, you know, we don't really know until we start, you know, doing this work, until we get some hands-on time with these new technologies, these new modes of working. I'm sort of reminded of the early 18th century electrical machine. So I'm putting on an old historian of science hat here, but at the time that it was built, that, you know, Hauksbee's electrical machine, it was really used as a toy. I mean, it was something that they kind of rolled out at the Royal Society. They would, you know, fire it up and turn a crank and the evacuated globe would glow, and they would show it off to wealthy patrons. And it was sort of a parlor trick. You know, there was sort of a glowing globe of static electricity, and that was something that was fun and interesting and cool. But there was really not a whole lot of scientific purpose to it. It didn't really for a very long time go anywhere. It was static electricity was essentially a game, a parlor trick for most of the 18th century until it wasn't anymore. Until in the later 18th century, it inspired and evolved into a whole new sort of a more scientific view of electricity and kind of the basis for you know, electrical physics as we know it today. And so I'm sort of struck by that, and that this criticism that I with my devil's advocate hat levied is that's exactly right. That's the response to it, is that, like, well, we don't know. And I think one of the things that's hard, I think, for academics to get their heads around is that I don't know answer. And we tend to use that a lot in the digital humanities, and I think it's a hard thing for people to accept that, you know, we are really experimenting. And we don't know where it's going to take us all the time. And that I think is not something we're very accustomed to in the humanities.
No. Well, but although our colleagues in other buildings on campus in the sciences are very accustomed to that, they often have no idea what the result of an experiment is going to be. They have some clues, but then also they run a different experiment and they end up with the glue on the post-it note that we all love so much, which was a complete accident. So, I think you're right, Tom, that we often don't know what's going to happen with these. But, you know, I went into this conference with that question in front of me and kind of worried about it, because I wanted to know, like, if I'm going to come back and try to convince somebody to buy me a craft robo, then, you know, and spend $300 of our department technology budget on that, I need to be able to say. I can't say, well, I don't know what the tangible outcome is going to be. So the example that Bill and I played around with at the conference was, one of the things that I'm very interested in is the kind of ephemeral street art of graffiti, which is something, I guess, you know, the first cave drawings were some form of graffiti, but something that's been with us in human society for a very long time, and it's a global phenomenon. It happens in all sorts of different ways, and it's there today and it's gone tomorrow, and or at least gone as soon as the now city authorities can come along and paint over it. And so I've been over the years collecting examples of tagging on buildings and things like that by taking pictures of them, and our students see that. You know, I can show them pictures of tags that I've taken pictures of, you know, stencil tags and that sort of thing. And they see it, and they see it in downtown Washington. They see it here in the city of Fairfax. You know, it happens everywhere, but they don't really think about it much unless they themselves are art students or perhaps taggers in their own right, which hopefully not too many of them are. But so what Bill and I did was we took one of those tags, which I dubbed the Angry Worm, because that was about the closest title I could put on it. it was on, you know, in the city of Vienna, Austria, a couple of years ago when I was there with some students. And so Bill and I were able to take that image that I took, port it over into Illustrator, Adobe Illustrator, and then from there create a stencil from it, and then go around Niagara-on-the-Lake and tag buildings for the rest of the day. Fortunately, it was Bill that did that, not me. although they have been asking for Kevin's phone number, I think, ever since. But the reason I cite that is, you could still say, well, where's the history there? Well, now I could give that to my students and say, okay, now, you know, tag your notebook with that. And not a building on campus, but just try to do that. It's not easy to do, or try to create something like that. That's not easy to do. So there's an artistic process that went on here that we're just replicating through digital means. And now what if you could replicate something from the 15th century? And how complicated would that, you know, the decorations on monasteries, how difficult would that be to do? And so, as Bill said, you know, when they start grappling with evidence is a tangible thing as opposed to an image on the screen in the classroom or a picture in a book, but it becomes an actual tangible thing that they try to do something with, my hope is that they're going to start thinking about it in some slightly different ways and maybe come up with some new insights. I mean, it's one of the participants in the conference, Stéphane Levesque, said that, you know, he has in his book on thinking, historical thinking, that, you know, if you tried to coach a sports team the way we teach history students, the sports would have died out a long time ago, because we stand up in the class and we tell the students all about the past, and that's what that's the standard mode of teaching. And even if they, we have interactive exercises and that kind of thing, but only rarely do we actually take our students into an archive and have them produce real historical knowledge. Where if you're coaching a sports team, you can tell the kids what to do, but that doesn't work. You have to get them on the rink, or since we're talking about Canada, or out in a field somewhere, and give them a ball or a hockey puck or whatever, and have them start to play. So that's where I think it is actually, this is actually a little different. And the unconference format made it possible for us as participants to also have that experience of play that we wouldn't normally have in a standard conference environment.
But see, now this is where I think we, what seems like very out in left field, I guess, to traditional scholars in history, actually, I think wraps around and becomes very comprehensible to those who do, let's say, the history of the book, who learn about printmaking and really understand how a book is put together physically. Then they can go to an archive and really understand, what it means when you see pages that aren't cut, or look very carefully at the kind of binding. These sorts of things become historical clues. And I think that there's probably some evangelism we could do to talk about the way in which this is actually ultimately less radical than I think people think, that the kinds of things that Bill and Kevin are doing are really to just recapture more of material culture history beyond textual history, which we have been too focused on, I think, as professional historians. And, I think it's sort of an open secret that this is something that would help you out if you understood how things are made, put together. And then I also think, like you said, Mills, just the fact that you went to this conference or this unconference, it may not be actually, you might have some immediate result, but you could think two or three years down the road of some kind of classroom scenario where it might be really handy to have an exercise similar to what you've done there. And I think that's really important, that there might be delayed outcomes or something that you think back upon in the same way that when we read a book, we might not have immediate thoughts of how it could impact our own research, but then you might think about it years later.
Well, let me then take that and turn to one other thing that I noticed, just both as a participant in the conference, but as an observer of the conference as it was happening. And that is, it seemed to me that there were kind of two groups of people out of the 20 there. And that is those that were there because of their strong interest in games and gaming, and those that were there who were there because of their interest in not games or gaming. They were people like, that's not why I was there, because I'm not a gamer. And sometimes I was a little worried that sometimes, we were going to be sort of talking on different planes and not really understanding one another. But it seemed to me that that wasn't the case. I don't know, Kevin, Bill, what was your perspective on that? Were the gamers and the non-gamers able to really have a conversation where they all made sense to each other?
I think absolutely. We did not want this to be a conference about gaming. And so, because that's my focus, or serious gaming at least is my focus, I know a lot of people in the community who could have been a part of that, and so that was one of the challenges for me, was I wanted to invite them, but I realized pretty quickly that if I did, then we would have 20 people talking about history games in the room and it would be over. And I think a lot of us who've been doing this, I know I've certainly felt this way in the past year or so. Rog McDougall as well was talking along a similar line at the conference. Having some doubts about some of the claims that were made, let's say 5 years ago, about what gaming could do in history or serious gaming might do in history. And so, in a way, some of our research has moved forward and we can stand back and be a little bit more critical. But, more broadly, I think what we wanted it to be about was obviously play. And so, you can play in games, but there are lots of other places that you can play. And sometimes, as Rob pointed out, getting out of games is actually a much better idea. In some of the foundational literature in gaming, two concepts arise, and they're on a spectrum. So at one end is ludus, which is a very focused kind of gaming situation in which you have clear rules and a goal that you're trying to achieve. And at the other end is paideia. And paideia is open and free play. So paideia would be bouncing a ball in your driveway, and ludus is playing basketball at high school on a team against another high school's team. And so I think what we wanted to do is get away from that ludus side towards the paideia side and recognize that this is a spectrum, but that games are not the only place where play can happen. And I think the gamers came in knowing that, but it was helpful to hear it again. And I think the non-gamers came in, you know, and maybe heard the gamers speaking a little more comprehensively than maybe we had in the past. Perhaps I'm just speaking for myself, but I certainly think, as I say, that we're able to be, well, I guess we have a little bit more of a context and a good view of things now that some of the initial enthusiasm around serious gaming has passed.
Bill, what do you think? The gamers and the non-gamers talking to or past each other?
No, I think I really agree with what Kevin said, that the kind of emphasis was really shifting toward the play end of the spectrum. I mean, just speaking for myself, I don't have anything against games, but I'm a lot more interested in play and being playful and playing as a kind of a way of learning new things. And I think that, I mean, from one of the things that I found interesting, though, was in our discussions on the second day when we talked about playful, play tended to slide toward the games end of things rather than the toys end of things, even though many of the participants later sort of said, well, yeah, I had some toy-like examples, but it just didn't occur to me to mention them in context.
One of the things that I think has happened is that those of us who were really focusing on serious gaming and what it might do in the humanities and might do in history were going in that direction because we were frustrated by the reification of text. So this notion that history was text. And I think for two or three years, what happened was, in this small community, that history became games. So we went from reifying one thing and reacting to that reification to reifying another thing. And as I say, what I think is happening now is that we're recognizing that there is that spectrum and we need to move away from that and have a more comprehensive view. And that was certainly there. I think the default is sometimes to start talking about play and then go to the conventional form, in the same way that we talked about history and went to the conventional form of text. So it's a journey. As I say, I was really pleased that we're becoming more comprehensive. And, you know, the stuff that you're doing, Bill, is newer or at least newer to those people who haven't heard of it before. And I think as time goes on, I'm really excited about what's going to happen in the next 2 to 3 years. I think the notion of toy is going to become much more a part of our discourse and conversation.
Yeah, and before too much longer, maybe Bill and I will actually get together and build the magic wand idea that we came up with. And well, Kevin, you talk about things being a journey. I mean, that's a kind of a segue into some of the work you're doing at the Simulating History project that you're working on. Can you talk just a little bit about some of the mobile apps that you're working on? Because this is something we've talked about a lot on the podcast, is the future of mobile history computing.
Yeah, so just to stick with the journey, initially my focus was on 3D environments. And you know, the argument's been made that what we've seen in the last 10 years is a shift from entering into the box of the computer and into virtual reality to pulling computing out and taking it into the real world. So I've built 3D environments, and on the spectrum, sticking with the notion of spectrum for a second, although a different one now, I've kind of done that journey from the box out. So 2005, 2006 was a very big, expensive, and wonderful virtual environment that took a tremendous amount of time to building an isometric environment. And for those people who aren't familiar with it, an isometric environment is one in which you take a God's eye view. And so you're looking down on a map or a game board or whatever metaphor you want to use. And so that's a simulation that's out now that deals with epidemics. And then continuing along the spectrum, I move further away, and now I'm building an application that's really a tour of Niagara on the Lake, where the conference was. And the idea is that you will download this little application onto your iPhone, and you can walk around Niagara on the Lake, and you can take a conventional kind of tour in which you roam. We're calling it roam mode. You can just roam around town, and as you come to different buildings, GPS knows where you are, and so we'll tell you about the building that you happen to be standing beside, and we'll also tell you where to find the washrooms and everything else in town that a tourist might need. And then what we also have as part of the same application is more of a quest mode, or opportunity for you to go on a quest and try and solve a mystery that we created in the town. And in the course of doing that quest and moving around town to different places and different sites, you learn about the early 19th century, and specifically the War of 1812 in Niagara, what it meant to people and what people have thought about it in retrospect. So I started off by saying that the virtual environment was a lot of work. Everything's a lot of work, as we all know now. But it was a lot of fun to literally be out, and to also be out in the sense of away from the academy and thinking about public history. And we're expecting a tremendous influx of visitors into Niagara for the bicentennial of the War of 1812. So I'm not sure what's going to happen in the United States, but it's going to be a big deal for us. So with all these visitors, we thought this was a wonderful opportunity to get people to think about what happened a couple of hundred years ago in this specific location and what it's meant for us since.
Yeah, given what happened in Washington during the War of 1812, I think there might not be a lot of commemoration here. So,
extra guards around the White House.
Yeah. I took that tour, and it was really, really interesting. Tom, you would have chuckled along with me, because it was very, very similar to something that Tom and I and Josh Greenberg, who was formerly at the Center for History and New Media, now at the New York Public Library, and at the conference as well. The three of us had thought a number of years ago it would be fun to do something like this, and we talked to one of the cell phone providers, Sprint Nextel, I think it was, and they were kind of interested in it, but the technology was nowhere near what it is today.
Yeah, and pre-iPhone, yeah, pre-apps.
People didn't talk about apps then, and we weren't even sure how it would be possible to make it. We knew it could be done. Our idea was something similar to what, Kevin, you developed, but it was to stop Booth from assassinating Lincoln. And so send you off on a quest through D.C. And it was just not possible several years ago. I mean, it was technically possible, but it would have required such an expenditure of time and effort that we pretty quickly gave up on it. And now the technological environment has changed so much that I got to walk around Niagara on the lake with an iPhone in my hand and learn about the War of 1812. It was really, in particular, as somebody who's spent a lot of time thinking about K-12 teaching recently, I can't wait to see kids wandering around D.C. doing similar, in cities wherever, doing similar kinds of things, because I think that's going to be really, really popular. So let's see. Now, Bill, one thing you work at, one of your projects is the Lab for Humanistic Fabrication. We've talked a lot about this during the podcast today, but can you sum up humanistic fabrication in just a few sentences?
Sure. I guess if you kind of ask the person on the street what their idea of a great humanist would be, they might come up with somebody like Da Vinci or Cellini or somebody like that. It wasn't until relatively recently, if you take the long view, that humanists stopped working with their hands and stopped making things, as well as writing things, or stopped painting, stopped photographing, doing all of those things to focus on text. And so what I've been trying to do over the past few years is start to bring these kind of practices of making back into my own work, into the work of my students, into the graduate teaching, to see what happens if you take the perspective that humanists can make more than texts as ways of communicating their understanding about, in the big view, about what it means to be a human.
Okay, so you're not manufacturing humans. That was the concern of my 13-year-old. He said he's fabricating humans.
Well, I'm fabricating humanists.
Yeah. I explained that he had to read the whole word, not just humans. So, for those of you listening to the podcast today who haven't seen either Kevin's work or Bill's work, we'll link this up in the notes, the liner notes for the podcast, so you can visit both of their websites, because they're doing some really fascinating and interesting things and kind of even further out on the cutting edge than I had realized until I got a chance to spend some time with them. So it was really, for me, it was really stimulating and exciting to just have these kinds of conversations in depth. And again, that's what I think is one of the great advantages of the much more informal conference environment, is that not only did we have the unconference day and the day of more serious work, but we had, since we were a small group, we could spend a lot of time together just in the more informal, around the edges conversations, where things like what we've been talking about can get explained in detail, and it generates so many new ideas. So it was
when all the good things happen?
Yeah.
It's all on the fringes of the, I mean, even at a you know, button down academic conference. It's always the hallways, it's the lobby,
yeah,
the coffee shop,
or when your mind is wandering during that that 20-minute paper that's really a 30-minute paper. So
we really have to change that, don't we?
We do. It's I think, you know, I don't know anybody who loves that format. Certainly not the poor graduate students who have to get up and present for the first time in those environments, you know, when you can see the sweat running down their temples. And so,
you know, one thing that strikes me is that the advantage of those kinds of conferences is that, and I don't think we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, is that there are established conventions. And so you can feel quite comfortable about what's going to happen because the person who wrote the paper owns the mic and, you know, they're now in control. And what we did on day two, and this followed something that Bill has done, was that the writer of the paper wasn't allowed to speak. And so that person could ask clarifying questions of the others, but there was an appointed first reader for the paper who would talk about what he or she thought of the paper, and then the rest of the group commented. And as I say, the writer could only ask for clarification. But that requires a high degree of trust. And I think we were able to do that, and you're able to do that in small groups. But that, I think, is a challenge for taking this back to the bigger conference, because you're opening doors to a little bit of chaos. And sometimes that can be great, but that can also make people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that in the large conference environment, that I was thinking about that as and Kevin was, I have to say, very strict about the no talking rule. People would start to say something and he would, you know, raise his hand, no talking. So, but that just, you know, obviously all of us who've been to large academic conferences, that's not going to work because people are there so they can talk, not so that they can be told not to talk. But I think you're right that, you know, the trust issue is a really important one. And my own feeling is that the large conference is dead, but the corpse has just not wandered off yet. And because people don't like them. The only people who like them are the associations who depend on them for their income. But they've become sort of like the survey course that we, you know, the large lecture course that we know generates no actual learning among students, but is necessary to build our enrollment budget on. These large conferences don't generate much in the way of real intellectual activity, but they are necessary for the associations to build their budgets on. And so until we come up with some other way of funding our associations, we are probably stuck with these conferences.
Do you think people used to like them?
Yeah, because I think they used to be a lot smaller.
I think they used to be a lot more informal. I mean,
sure.
You talk to you know, members of the AHA or OAH who went to these meetings, and a lot, even the full professors would go and they would hobnob and there were cocktail hours. And I think people felt like it had a social function that was a little bit closer to the unconference than people might imagine.
And it was largely a good old boy network at the time, probably,
right,
you know, 80%, 90%, something like that. But, you know, our colleague Roy, who, you know, the founder of the Center for History and New Media, he actually wrote something a number of years ago about the reform of the American Historical Association's annual meeting and about how back in it was in the interwar period, I can't remember now if it was the 20s or the 30s, people were having these same kinds of complaints that we're airing today. And so the reform was to add the discussant to the panel, thereby adding a fourth paper to go along with the other three.
A huge leap forward, I believe that was called.
I think so.
Yes, a great leap forward. Yes.
Well, you know, this has been really great, Kevin and Bill, having you on the podcast today. It's, you know, as I say, I think it was one of the best conferences I've ever attended, and you know, I came back really, really inspired, and actually very uncommon for me. I sat down right after I got back and started trying to finish my paper because I didn't want to lose the thinking and the enthusiasm that had been generated there. And so I'm actually almost done. And whether I finish is a whole other story, but I am almost done, which is very unusual for me. Usually I leave a conference and don't want to think about it. So you know, thanks for putting this all together. And here on the podcast, we're going to check back in when the book is done and see what's been happening and what other kinds of things have been generated by the conference. So we really appreciate you being on the podcast today, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, thanks for having us.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear.
please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you